You've lived in California, Portland, New York, Abu Dhabi, Botswana, India. What drew you back to Montana?
All the places that I've lived in my life, I found that I was still, you know, in my work orbiting the West, and that everything I wrote ended up being about, you know, Montana and these kinds of small towns where I grew up. And I kind of realized that the process of living in all these places that were so radically different from it and from each other were sort of a process of helping me to see the place I was from more clearly. And after being away for about 15 years, it just felt like it was time to come home, time to kind of re-experience it in the flesh again. I felt like I had this perspective now of, because, you know, wherever you're from, wherever you grow up, you're so used to it that you don't kind of realize all the things that are so weird and unique about it. And so for me, living in all these other places, they helped me to see Montana so much more clearly. And I felt that as I was kind of reaching this point where I felt ready to do my, you know, I guess adult work, or you know, I'd kind of felt like I was starting to become the writer I wanted to be, it felt like it was time to just come back here and really live among what I wrote again.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Maxim Loskutov about his collection of short stories, Come West and See, which Matt Gallagher calls a ferocious love letter to the forgotten and the scorned. Don't go away. In an interview with NPR's Ari Shapiro, you talk about the struggle with our urge to love the land and our urge to tame it. So you grew up in Missoula, Montana. I'm curious how you witnessed that struggle in particular.
Yeah, I think you see it kind of inevitably all around you here in Missoula. I mean, when I was a kid, Missoula was still very much a mill town. And so, you know, I remember sort of these conflicts, you know, when I was a kid between, you know, my classmates whose fathers and mothers worked out at the paper mill, and then those other kids whose parents were so furious about how the air smelled bad every day and how you'd get these inversions where you could, you know, hardly see your hand in front of your face. And so I think those were sort of my earliest, as a little kid, kind of internalizing these conflicts between this idea of using the land and using the resources of the West versus protecting them, and the way that as citizens here, you know, we and this was sort of one of my very earliest experiences, was being in awe of this landscape, while at the same time you're trying to carve out a life for yourself here, and that entails using and changing the landscape. And that was always, you know, when I was a little kid, I think you feel things so strongly. And I was a kid who felt anytime I saw a clear cut, it was just like, I felt like I died inside. How could anybody possibly do that? But then I would meet kids at school and I was like, oh, my dad does that. That's how we eat. That's, you know, that's how you live in a wood house, right? And so, you know, when you're a little kid, you're like kind of taking in these very basic, strange little contradictions in yourself, and you're trying to figure them out. And, you know, those contradictions are still what fascinate me.
The book begins in Montana Territory, 1893, where a man falls in love with a bear. And there are several stories in which wild animals and nature are in conversation with humans in relationships. There's a wounded pet coyote that interferes with a relationship, a python that breaks apart roommates, and a tree that causes problems in a marriage, and of course this bear. So I'm really wanting to know about your impulse to write about nature and wildness and how it, you know, intersects with humans.
Yeah. I think it relates to your last question. You know, for me, all these things are about this sort of this love of the wild coming into conflict with our desire to tame it. And for me, ever since I was a little kid, I think one of the blessings of growing up in Montana and going to public schools in Montana is that at a really young age, I was exposed to a lot of Native American mythology and stuff that I had just felt really instinctively, like going on hikes with my dad. And I saw a mountain lion once, and it was like just such a powerful experience for me as a little kid. I felt so connected to that animal, but then that animal would eat me. And so I think I've always been fascinated by the way that we try to sort of instill human characteristics into wild things, even though they are sort of what we love about them is their intrinsic wildness, is the fact that they aren't human. And so that's often sort of a starting point in a story for me is a relationship to this wild animal being kind of a symbol for the part of a relationship or an environment or an event in someone's life that can't be controlled and that sort of spirals out of their hands and then changes them in some irrevocable way.
I want to come back to how wildness exists in the land and with humans, but first I just want to have you read from Prey.
Of course. Prey. I wake from a dream knowing that someone or something is in my bed. All the muscles in my arms and back are rigid. I roll over. A single lidless eye gleams on the pillow beside me, milk chocolate brown with an elliptical pupil, swollen now in the near dark. It's Voldemort, smiling at me with her long, double-hinged jaws. I scramble out of bed, slivers of dawn leaking through the blinds and across my bare legs. What you doing, girl? I ask. You have a bad dream? She's stretched as long as she can make herself, like a spear. It's a startling way to see her. Usually she's coiled up or doing the S slither. Her head on my pillow is next to an orange Cheeto stain, and her glossy gold and black body extends the length of the blue comforter and off the end of the bed. She's almost 8 feet long. You've grown, I tell her. It occurs to me that when we're lying side by side, she's a lot longer than I am. I lift her midsection and drag her back to her tank under the window. She's at least 100 pounds. Her skin is slick, not wet, but not quite dry. It's surprisingly cool, like spaghetti that's been left out overnight. She starts to curl around my arm. You're too big for that, too, I say, pulling away. Her tank runs the length of my wall. It has a heat lamp and fake foliage, a heated log, branches that she likes to drape herself over, and a pool to soak in. A Hermione Granger doll sits in the corner. I spend most of my extra money heating the tank and buying her food and toys. The lid is pushed open. I think back on last night. A meatball hot pocket, push-ups, some porn. Maybe I didn't latch the lid properly after I tried to feed her. The uneaten rat is gnawing a fake leaf by the pool. Bad snake, I whisper, kissing her face and putting her on her log. Stay, I snap the lid shut. I get back in bed and stare at the plastic stars on my ceiling.
In the story Prey and there's another story, we're in this together, you know, God, where there's a sense of loyalty to the wild thing, to the bad thing, you know, to the thing that's scary and might harm. In the second story, we're in this together, you know, God, there's a very naughty, troubled child. And I really want to understand your sense of the part of you that's loyal to the thing that's wild and might eat you, and the part of you that rejects it or is scared of it.
I think for me, it kind of goes back to that. We as humans have this capability to love things which aren't good for us, you know, and that's fascinating. We don't love in our best interest. And, you know, I think that's something I've seen in myself and I see in everyone all around me. And it feels like a very kind of uniquely human thing. That's not something you're seeing in other parts of the animal kingdom. And so, yeah, that's something that's often kind of plays into my stories and into my writing is the way that, yeah, we can fall in love and have this incredible loyalty for something that wants to destroy us. And, you know, in the case of Prey, it's a pet snake that wants to eat its owner. And in the case of We're in This Together, it's a daughter who through really no fault of the parents, just is capable of incredible cruelty. And that story came from, I have a friend who's a nurse at a ward for children with these kinds of personality disorders. And, you know, what she said was the hardest and most striking part of the job when she started was, you expect a bad kid to have bad parents. You know, you expect there to be a logic to it, that there's some reason why this kid is behaving this way. And that's often not the case at all. A lot of these kids have wonderful, loving parents who just cannot understand how their child could do such a thing. And so, you know, yeah, for me, that dovetails very naturally with this, you know, this kind of perplexing ability we have to love things which would do us harm.
And the jacket of your book claims that the stories offer radical empathy and startling insights into the wounds of American people. What are the wounds?
That's a big question. I think that we, you know, you can see them all around us. I mean, I think that America from its very beginning has been reckoning with itself and reckoning with the fact that it was founded on this incredible cruelty. It was founded on genocide and mass murder and eradication of a culture and abuse of other cultures and this sort of incredible desire to sort of to take over and change a wild land. And I think those the ramifications and those scars are certainly with us today, and they play out. They're playing out in such a vivid way in the West, I think, right now, as the West is in this process of going through these sort of radical changes where, you know, so many of the economies that existed, even when I was a kid, you know, logging and mining, have, you know, moved to other countries or just been expended here. And, you know, so a lot of these small towns are either dying or changing. They're losing that, what used to be their sort of heart blood, and becoming either a tourist destination or, you know, some kind of a tech hub. And so you have this sort of violent cultural anger. And I mean, of course, we're seeing it all around us. You know, I wrote this book sort of as a warning, thinking that this was something we'd have to face down the road. You know, I didn't think it would be so vivid, you know, by the time it came out. And the battles over public lands, which are kind of foundational in the background of the book, you know, they felt like they were in the background of the country when I wrote it, and they feel like they're in the foreground now.
Specifically, you're talking about the readout. And can you describe or explain the readout both as you envisioned it or implanted it in the book and also how we see it or how we've seen it playing out the news and reality?
Yeah. Well, it was something that was fascinating to me because I think it's another way in which the West, like everywhere else in this country, is so segregated. I grew up in Missoula, and I had never heard of the readout until I was in college. And I hadn't really heard of any, you know, there are many sort of separatist kind of movements that have taken place around Montana. The readout itself was this idea. It was founded by this guy named John Wesley Rawls, who envisioned forming this place where like-minded Christian people could come together and take over local governments and instill law enforcement officers that would only enforce the Constitution itself. That would be this very kind of limited government and this Christian society. So, you know, and all these groups are sort of waiting for the end times to come. So the idea of a readout is sort of creating this fortress against the coming darkness. And for those people, that's what Montana is. You know, for my family, that's not what Montana is at all. And, you know, you can spend your sort of whole life living near these kinds of communities. I mean, there are tons of them out in the Bitter, you know, within an hour of Missoula, there's all kinds of places like this without ever really encountering them. And so that felt like a very important aspect of the book that I wanted to write, was to show how, you know, something can be life or death in one town, and then in another town an hour away, it can be like either something that most people haven't heard of or the people who have heard of think it's a joke. And that was something that I, as I grew older, I came to be sort of very disturbed by in the West, how we are so, you know, how you can live in a city like Portland, Oregon, and be and think that the West must be this sort of wild liberal mecca. And then, you know, a half hour away is utterly the opposite. And I think that one of the things that's the most disturbing about what's happened in the West today is just how deep those divisions have gotten and how little communication there is between the two sides.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Maxim Loskatov about his collection of short stories, Come West and See. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. So coming back to the point of empathy, how do you see your book cultivating empathy?
Yeah, I see the book, I wrote the book as a conversation between the two sides. So basically the way the stories are laid out is it kind of goes story to story. So you'll have one story that's from the perspective of a person who's, you know, supportive and basically intimately involved in the readout in some way. Either they have a loved one who has gone there to join this struggle, or they feel the desire within themselves to go and join it, or they basically identify as part of this society that has been pushed aside and needs to fight back. And then the other half of the stories are from people who are living in the cities of the West, places like Missoula or Portland or Denver, who are, you know, often only glancingly aware of what's happening through their news feed or some other website, and who find it basically ridiculous, but who are also struggling to find their place in the modern West, and who are in their own way feeling lost in this landscape and feeling alienated in their relationships, and, you know, feeling that paradox that we talked about at the very beginning of loving the wild, but then also wanting to tame it and kind of getting lost within that.
You write about broken masculinity. And I was listening to an interview with the Australian author Tim Winton on BBC's Hard Talk. And what he said is that there are fractures of masculinity that come from settler culture. And I wanted to throw this quote by you and see what you thought, which is that settler culture, the impulse is to come, claim, invade, dig in, consolidate, defend. It's a closed fist, closed heart, closed mind mentality. You know, that we valorize toughness and silence and strength. How do you see the settler culture as related to your book and to the masculinity, the versions that you present?
Yeah, I think that's so smart. I mean, one of the sort of central kind of galvanizing event of the uprising that takes place in the readout in the background of my book is it's a fictionalized version of what happened out at the Malheur Refuge a couple years ago as I was writing this book, when a group of men went and took over a wildlife refuge in protest of the arrest of two ranchers for their failure to pay grazing fees for BLM lands and a long history of conflict with BLM employees. And to me, that it exactly speaks to that instinct. I think that the tradition of white men in the West was to go out and take something, and there isn't much left to take, you know. And so you have this sort of a generation with a lot of anger and a lot of just of struggling to find an identity for themselves. And I think that they do very much still identify with that settler cowboy ideal of you go out into the landscape here in the West and you take something. You take a piece of land from the natives who are there. You cut down the trees, you transform it, and you make a life there. And that's sort of, that is what it is to be a man. And that isn't really possible anymore. So you have a lot of the characters in my book are, you know, men who long for that, but then they live in a town where the mills have closed and they are working at a gas station and they're living in a trailer and they're like, what is the point of all of this? And so That being said, I think that these kinds of broken masculinities certainly aren't isolated to one side or the other of the political spectrum. I think that it's a huge challenge in the world today as we, you know, I think that humanity right now is sort of being forced to reckon with its own nature just due to the fact that there isn't much room left. I mean, we used to have these release valves, you know, we used to have, that was what the West was this kind of great national release valve where, you know, young people from the East who didn't have a job or a purpose there, they could come out here. And there were these frontiers. This wasn't solely an American idea. There were frontiers all over the world. And, you know, we don't have that. We're forced to live side by side now and side by side with people who are very different from us. And so, yeah, I think that all over in the world, what we're seeing right now, you know, very clearly is this kind of broken masculinity sort of raising its angry head and trying to assert itself in the world. And it's terrifying because there isn't a place for it anymore.
That's fascinating. The themes that came to mind are that your characters were impoverished in some way, that they were being denied something. And what I hear you saying is they're being denied that release valve. Coming back around to land, one of the things I found curious is this book is plainly about the West, and yet you don't linger on landscape and you're not lyrical and you don't talk about leaves and rainfall. And so I was just really curious, is this a new version of the West? And why is the landscape not a central character?
Yeah, I think that, you know, part of my project is sort of a deromanticization of the West. I mean, I of course, am constantly struck by the beauty around me. But for me, the West is often more related to a trailer park in front of the most beautiful mountain that you've ever seen, or, you know, a place that's just falling apart and a yard that's full of tires. And, you know, these are the kind of hidden West that I grew up around. It wasn't John Wayne riding off between these magnificent pillars of red rock. It was, there's graffiti on the red rock and there's a bunch of trailers at the bottom and there's, you know, like 60 junked out cars for some reason that you're like, how did those get out there? And so, yeah, I mean, for me, it's one of the things, ways in which I feel lucky as a writer is I feel like I have something to say that hasn't been said before. Like that was what I felt like I was searching for a long time when I was starting out writing. And I do think there's a way in which sort of the reality of the New West hasn't been written, and a way in which the history, I mean, the reason that this book starts with the story about the bear is to kind of show that this sort of brokenness and this paradox and this struggle have been there from the very beginning. And the way that they manifest isn't in this kind of majestic beauty that I think a lot of people from the East, when they, you know, when I was on tour of the West, that, you know, I would see in people's eyes, they think of it as this kind of like paradise, this wonderland. Also this place, like, why would you live out there? But, you know, my experience of the West is constantly these contradictions of, you know, this incredibly beautiful natural space with this incredibly sort of harsh human intrusion on it.
You have talked about the West in your own life as a place to leave behind or to leave. And I'm thinking about this sense of frontier. For you, the frontier, I imagine, was civilization and art and culture and cities. What do you know about your own pursuit of frontier?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, growing up here, I always wanted to leave. You know, I had this sense of, even from when I was a little kid, wanting to be a writer and an artist and feeling like all of that was happening somewhere else, you know, like feeling like to do that, I had to go to, you know, New York and LA or, you know, the great big cities around the world. And I did. And you know, that very much was the frontier for me, you know, like the idea of, oh, can I make it in New York as a little kid in Montana was like, I kind of imagined how for a little kid in New York in the 1800s, it was like, man, can I make it out in Montana? And so, yeah, there definitely was that kind of desire to sort of push myself out of what I knew. And when I was doing it, I was doing it very much for that sort of like base reason of like trying to just carve out an identity for myself. But I realized later that also what I was doing was trying to understand the place that I came from. And I think that for me, at least, the only way I could really begin to understand Montana and the West was by going away and living in places that were so different. And through that lens, being able to look back on the West and then begin to think about it critically and begin to see these conflicts, which have then become the heart of my writing.
In your pursuit of this artistic career, you encountered David Foster Wallace, whom you thank at the beginning of your acknowledgments. Why did you put him first, and what did you learn from him?
Well, I put him first because he helped me more than anyone else has. I mean, I don't know that I would be doing this if it weren't for him. And the reason being, I had never heard of him when I met. I went to college in L.A. at a small school called Pomona College, and I went there for a lot of like weird reasons, like basically wanting to be in a warm place at a small liberal arts school, you know, and I knew I had this interest in writing, and he was the writing guy there. And I didn't, it wasn't until I kind of remember the horrified look on my freshman year roommate's face when I told him I didn't know who this guy was and I wanted to be a writer. But, he was there the 4 years I was there, and I studied with him that whole time. And I think, the main thing that I learned from him was just how hard you have to work. I mean, it was just this sort of diligence and dedication. I mean, one thing that I'm so grateful for about him and the way that he taught was he never tried to make you write like him. You know, my writing couldn't be more different than David Foster Wallace's. I mean, I have to push myself to make a story more than 10 pages long. The idea of a 1,500-page book to me is like you'd have to be an alien to write it. And he was so supportive of that and interested and fascinated in all the different kinds of writing that students were doing. But sort of this baseline value that he instilled, I think, in all of us was just to never stop working. Like, it's never good enough. Like, you're always going to be learning. You're always going to be trying to get better. And to actually do this thing well, you have to work at it so, so hard. And that's, I'm still in the middle of that. I don't feel anywhere close to where I want to be. And I'm so grateful for that kind of work ethic that he instilled, because it's sort of the engine that drives me to this day.
Maxim Loskatov was born and raised in Missoula, Montana. When he's not traveling the world or participating in various artist residencies and fellowships, he returns to the open land of the West. Look for more information about his work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008, and thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin's studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.